comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks. Welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. Some of you are joining us for the very first time. Welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here. I think you'll be glad you're here as well. And I hope you make a habit out of it. Tonight is K-Files night. That means that right after the show tonight, we begin sending out the K-Files e-zine. That's our free weekly newsletter. The free weekly newsletter comes to your inbox. It's emailed to you. And there are no strings attached. When we say free, we really mean free. It really is free. All right? So if you haven't subscribed, go over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com. And you'll see the little button that says K-Files e-zine. Click on that and subscribe. You'll get a confirmation email. You have to click that link in the confirmation email. The whole thing takes maybe 10, 15, 20 seconds. And then you're in. In's a good place to be. I think most of you are aware of the fact that I have a channel over at YouTube, and I've got a few videos on there, and from time to time I add a video. Well, I added one today, and you'll want to take a look at it. I think it has to do with the moon rock that the Apollo 11 astronauts gave to the Prime Minister of the Netherlands after they returned from space, and they did a goodwill tour around the world, and they gave this moon rock to the Prime Minister of the Netherlands. Well, it turns out, you see, I've been saying all along that the moon rocks stand as evidence that the Apollo moon landings were not hoaxed, because hundreds of those rocks were given out to laboratories and scientists around the world. And no one has ever come forward and said, you know what, that moon rock you gave us is not a moon rock. So all those scientists have looked at them and they've all said, well, you know, it's not a moon rock. I mean, they've all said it is a moon rock. None have said it's not a moon rock. Well, this one that they gave to the Prime Minister in the Netherlands sort of shakes that a bit. After he passed away, that moon rock went to the museum in Amsterdam, and they had some experts do tests on it. And as it turns out, it's not a moon rock. NASA, the museum had vetted this moon rock by making a telephone call to NASA. This is before they did the test. Now they've done the tests. It's not a moon rock. NASA has no comment on it. They just say, well, we don't know what happened. Pretty curious stuff. Pretty curious stuff. But you might want to go over to YouTube after the show and take a look at that video. My channel is youtube.com/KSSHOW, KS Show. We'll be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Before I bring our guest up online, there is one additional announcement that I need to make. And I think many of you are familiar with Tom McCallum. Now, Tom McCallum is one of our listeners in Australia. And you would be familiar with him because he came from Australia to America and went out on South Mountain with me, and we videotaped that. The videotape of that, I believe, is in our members area in the Video Galaxy. It's not a tape. It's a video. But anyway, Tom wrote to me and sent me an email and said that, you know, he started having some physical problems, went to the doctor, and they found two brain tumors. And so he had surgery. I believe it was yesterday. They removed those. Some of you, sort of in the inner circle there, I sent you an email and asked you to be thinking about Tom. And if you pray, pray for Tom. And so he's out of surgery. And he is, they've removed the tumors. He's recovering well. But you want to keep your thoughts going to Tom McCallum. Your best wishes, your good energies, your prayers, whatever it is that you do, do it for Tom McCallum. We really appreciate his support for the show. And he's been a very faithful listener and has participated by sending emails and by sending flash messages and also by going out on the mountain with me. So keep Tom in the top of your mind there, okay? Now, my guest tonight is someone that some people have referred to as the real Dumbledore. And for those of you who are still living in the 20th century and have no idea who Dumbledore is, he is the headmaster in the Harry Potter movies. He is the headmaster of the Hogwarts School of Wizardry. Well, this fellow is not fiction. Dumbledore is fiction. This guy is not fiction. His name is Oberon Zell Ravenheart. And he joins us tonight. He is the headmaster of a real school of wizardry. It is called the Grey School of Wizardry. Oberon, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. It's a delight to have you with us this evening.
Thank you, Kevin. I'm glad to be here.
All right, let's sort of dispel a little bit of the fiction that goes with wizardry. And we'll do that by saying I think everyone is familiar with the fiction about vampires that was written by Bram Stoker. That's how everyone knows about Dracula, but most people think Dracula's fiction. There is a real Count Dracula, Vlad Dracula, and he was not a vampire, but there is a real Vlad Dracula behind the fiction. And there are real wizards behind the fiction that you see in Harry Potter and other movies. And that's really what we're here to talk about tonight, is real wizardry. Do you mind if I share a little bit of information about your school before we start?
Not at all. Please do.
All right. The Grey, and it's spelled G-R-E-Y, School of Wizardry, is an outgrowth of the Grey Council, which is a team of 24 mages and sages. Members of the Grey Council follow many different paths and may have orientations and perspectives that differ from each other, but they all hope to spark the imagination, beauty, and power of the minds of seekers everywhere. They work together over the year 2003 to weave the best lessons from many of the magical community's most respected elders and teachers into the, and I may mispronounce it, but I think it's pronounced grimoire, of the apprentice wizard, compiled by Oberon Zell Ravenheart, and he is our guest. Now, this is the basic textbook for a full 7-year academic curriculum of wizardry studies at the Gray School of Wizardry. Oberon, did I pronounce that correctly, or is it different?
No, you pronounced it perfectly correctly, Kevin. That's correct. Grimoire.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about... let's define some terms first that were used in this description, which I read and which comes from your website. What are mages as opposed to sages?
Well, mages is the is an ancient term. We have the story of the three magi in the Bible who visited the baby Jesus, and these refer to wizards of the Zoroastrian tradition of ancient Persia, and they were called magi, and it's from where we get our word magic, in fact, derives from that term. And a mage is basically a Persian term for what we consider a wizard today. In fact, wizards have been with us throughout all of the ages, and there have been a number of different names that have been used. In ancient Greece, they were called philosophers, and in modern times, they are often called scientists. But the name, the word, means essentially wise one. Wizardry is wisdom. That's what the essence of it is. In fact, the word, that's the origin of the word. Wizardry means wisdom, literally. Just as philosophy, literally, in Greek, means love of wisdom.
Okay. Now...
sages.
Yeah, sages.
Means wise one, elders. We talk about sages of the Orient, that kind of thing, you know. So these are all words that refer to people who are considered to be the wise ones in any culture.
Okay, so there's this Gray Council, which consists of 24 mages and sages. How did this council come to be, and when?
Well, I've been involved in the magical community for close to 50 years now, and during that time, I spent much of it the last 40 years or so, publishing one of the leading journals of this movement, a publication called Green Egg. And during the course of that publication, I came to know the people who were the leaders, the teachers, the founders of different groups and schools, because they were submitting articles for publication. I was reading their books that they were writing, traveling around the country and getting to know them personally. And we developed a relationship among us that was very much linked together, this vast community of the current renaissance of the same kind of thinking that has been the basis of all the renaissances in history, really. And so when it came time to put together a book for the 21st century that would pass on to the next generation what we consider to be the wisdom of the ages, which is what grimoires have done throughout history. This is only the latest of a succession of these that go all the way back to Imhotep of Egypt. Very, very long ago. So I was the one who actually connected with everybody and said, hey guys, let's do this and let's join together. The concept of a wizard's council is a tradition that goes all the way back through history to the most ancient times, so it wasn't much of a stretch to convene it in this time as well. I just happened to have been the catalyst to do so because I had this book project that I wanted to bring everybody in on.
All right, now, the material on your website says that this is designed for students of ages approximately 11 through 18.
Well, it was initially. We sort of thought that since we were designing an apprenticeship program, that we would focus on teenagers. Nobody else anywhere was offering any kind of magical teachings, lessons, or studies to the kids, and we really felt that was important. All of us in the Gray Council would have liked very much to have gotten these kind of teachings at an earlier age than they were available to us. and we felt that that was a innovation that we could do, is to make them available to youth. We were not entirely prepared, in fact, for the occasion that when we opened our doors on the 1st of August of the year 2004, three-quarters of the students signing up initially would be adults. And in fact, that has continued to be the case. Three-quarters of our students are adults all the way up into their 70s. And because these things that we are offering now were not available to them and have never been really available widely. The teachings that we have in the school, the 300-plus classes, are really quite unique. They would be very hard to find anywhere else.
We're going to talk a little bit tonight about the curriculum of the school, but I think at this point we ought to insert this bit of information, and that is that the Grimoire, and I know I'm not saying it right, and the school focus on magic as opposed to spirituality. What's the difference here? I think a lot of people standing on the outside of the circle looking in would say, oh, well, that's all occult religion or it's pagan religion. And you're saying, no, it's not religion, it's magic. So sort of define that for us.
Absolutely. I'm delighted to. That's another thing in which the Gray School is unique, is that we are in no way a religious school. And every other school that teaches any of the occult arts or magic or anything are all sponsored by different religious groups. Just as the vast majority of private schools in the country today are sponsored by different churches. We are not doing that. And part of the reason for that is that wizardry is not a religion. Throughout history, there have been significant and famous wizards of every religion known. In fact, quite a few have been the founders of religions. Moses was one of the great wizards. Solomon is regarded as a great wizard both in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, as he's referred to in that regard. Zarathustra in Persia, and in the Christian tradition we have Nostradamus and John Dee, who was the court wizard under the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. We have Leonardo da Vinci, you know, who is by no means a religious figure, but certainly one of the great wizards of all time. In more recent times, we've had significant people like Nikola Tesla, for example, who is widely regarded as a wizard. Even the Tesla's arch rival, Thomas Edison, was known as the Wizard of Menlo Park. That's what they called him, you know. So we feel that it's extremely important to remember that being a wizard is like being a philosopher or a scientist. It's a calling, it's a vocation, but it is not a religion. You know, a wizard is not a priest or a functionary of any particular religion. That's not to say that he may not be involved in a religion of his own. I mean, I myself am a pagan, but that is apart from being a wizard. And we have in the Gray School teachers and students of all kinds of religious persuasions, and some perhaps none at all. It's simply not what we are about.
All right, let's examine some of these departments that you have in the school. And by the way, one of the things, I want to say this for the audience, I told you when I talked with you on the phone and was asking you if you would be my guest on the show, but I want to say it for the audience. One of the things about the Gray School of Wizardry that impressed me, it's not the only thing, but one of the things, was that when I went to the website and clicked on the link for faculty and staff, it's not just a couple of people operating out of their hip pocket. There's a long list of faculty, and they have each of them long lists of credentials as to why they are part of the faculty. And so it's pretty impressive. But then also, you have divided the course of study into 16 departments for study. And if you don't mind, I'll just read this list and then we'll talk about them. There's 16 of them: wizardry, nature studies, magical practice, metaphysics, healing, wart cunning, divination, Performance Magics, Alchemy and Magical Sciences, Life Ways, Beast Mastery, Cosmology and Metaphysics. This one's interesting to me. I'm not sure what it is. I'll have to ask you. Mathemagics, Ceremonial Magic, Lore, and the Dark Arts. So there, the course of study is divided up into 16 different categories or departments. First, just because I'm curious, what in the world is Mathemagics?
Well, this is one of the most fascinating areas. One of the very earliest magical schools was the Pythagorean school in Athens, and the mysteries of mathematics and mathemagics were the basis of a great deal of the esoteric teachings of ancient times and still are today. The obscure relationships between different geometrical forms and shapes and algebra and mechanics and all of these things, it's fairly complicated stuff. There's numerology involved. There's such things as the psi factor and the pi factor and the Fibonacci series and the golden mean and many of these things. The concept was that mathematics, as they commonly call, but mathemagics as we refer to it, is the underpinning language of the universe. Some have said, have referred to it as the language of God, the structure that underlies all of nature. All of the physicists and scientists of today speak in this language, and if you don't, it's pretty hard to keep up with the advances, especially in you know, particle physics and cosmology and some of the really out there stuff. So that's really what this is at. It starts with the basic outlines of the teachings of the Pythagorean mysteries, and it goes right on all the way up to quantum mechanics. It's quite a...
Okay, I don't know what happened, but we just lost your audio. I hope you're still with us.
Oh, I'm still here. Yep. Are you not hearing me?
Well, the last part of your sentence, we heard this kind of a gong sound, and you were gone. So we may be having some outside help here tonight. Okay, so that's mathemagics.
Right.
Let's talk about wart cunning. What is that? And that's spelled, by the way, folks, it's W-O-R-T-C-U-N-N-I-N-G, wart cunning. What is that?
Right. Cunning is a medieval word for knowledge, and warts is a medieval word for herbs. So what this is herbology, herbalism, the knowledge of plants in all aspects of them, that they're, what their properties are.
I hate to do it. We have to step away. A break is taking over. But we'll be back on the other side of this break and find more about wart cunning. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking this evening with Headmaster Oberon Zell of the Gray School of Wizardry. And when we went away for break, Headmaster, you were telling us what is wart cunning.
Right. Well, I don't know how much of it you got, but basically wart cunning is the old name for what we call herbalism. And it's the knowledge of all the plants. How to grow them, what their uses are, medicinal and magical and every other way, how to find them in the wild, how to prepare them, how to make oils and tinctures and compresses and all kinds of things. It's a whole field in itself. Each of the departments of the Gray School is color-coded, so the color for wart cunning is green, green magic, as it were. And there's 16 different colors that we have here, so each department is so designated.
All right, now, how does that, that's department number 6 in the list, wart cunning. Department number 5 is healing. Okay, how does that different from, how is healing different from the wart cunning? Because it's, maybe I have a misconception, but it's been my conception that herbalism was about health.
Well, it's partly, but there's much more to it than that. Herbalism includes gardening. It includes ecological concerns and issues. There's really quite a lot to it. But yes, there's an overlap between these two departments. The Department of Healing, which is color is blue magic, encompasses all sorts of other healing modalities, especially not only traditional medicine, of course, but in things like anatomy and so on, but also everything from acupuncture and massage therapy to chromatography, color therapy. There's all kinds of healings, hands-on healing. It's a whole field itself. There are just many, many varieties, crystal healing, all kinds of stuff. So word cunning contributes to it, and as you say, there's an overlap in that area where herbal medicine is part of the healing field. It's just that there's so much else in each of these departments that it's necessary to have distinct departments.
All right, let's talk about divination for a moment, because I know which of these 16 the audience is really keyed in on.
Right.
Divination would be one of them, and perhaps it's divination that I know which ones they're keyed in on, but it's in my case, it's because of 9 years of answering emails and knowing what people are thinking about. What are we talking about here with divination?
Well, divination is simply all of the different means by which people have tried to discover the future, the fates and such. It's a huge area. The color for this department is yellow. And there are hundreds of different divination systems that have been invented over the years. I mean, I could go into details. I mean, alluromancy and erythmancy and bibliomancy and cartomancy and so on it goes. All the different mancies. The mancies is the mantic arts, and that all comes from the word mantis, which is diviner, is what it means. And we've got augury, which is reading omens, which is, you know, things that you go out and you just simply see, shapes of the clouds, the flights of birds, the which direction the wind's blowing. There's all that kind of stuff there. And there's lots of different things of that, and we teach about that too. There's horoscopy, what we call astrology commonly, using the positions of the planets and constellations and stuff at the time of one's birth or at the time of the reading to determine the fates, as it were. And of course there's the tarot, which is my personal favorite system, which is very widely known, with 78 special cards with illustrations that represent all the different archetypes. There's runestones, the casting of runes. There's palmistry or chiromancy, reading a person's character and fate by the lines in their hands. There's scrying, looking into a mirror or a crystal or a pool of water, many different sorts of things. The art of gazing art, like Galadriel's mirror in the Fellowship of the Ring, in Lord of the Rings, where she looked into the mirror, she said... Frodo said, "What will I see there?" And she said, "Things that were, and things that are, and things that may yet be." You know.
Mm-hmm.
So these are some of the different areas of divination, and it's a very popular department. Many people choose to major in that. And there's a lot of different systems.
That same pool of water kind of concept is in a couple of the Harry Potter movies as well.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely.
And where they can look, Harry looks into the pool of water and sees a scene from the past. And so the divination, and that brings up this question, because I don't know whether that part of it is fiction or whether that part of it is based on reality. Is divination the ability only to look into the future, or can you look into the past and see what happened in the past?
Oh yes, absolutely. It works both ways. Whichever way you turn your gaze, the whole concept of divination is simply to see beyond the moment that you're in. It's but it tends to use some external sorts of thing, rather than just simply going into a trance. That goes into a different area there. This is using some device.
And what's the purpose of the device? I mean, why is there any actual magical power in the device, or?
Well, it's not in the device. It's like this. All the divination systems rely on one simple process, and that's to find something that in its own is a random thing, whatever that may be, the casting of stones or drawing of cards or anything like that. And then what happens is that you find a way to then lay a template over that from which to deduce a pattern. And in all the systems of divinations are essentially means of laying a pattern of some kind. For example, in the tarot reading, you lay the cards out in a particular pattern according to the particular formula. There's several different patterns that are popular, the most popular being the one they call the Celtic cross. But each one is laid in order in a particular position, and that pattern then determines the meaning, which you would not get if you just threw the cards up in the air and just picked a bunch out. But even doing that, if you pick them out in an order, you can say, okay, the first one is the past, the second one is the present, the third one is the future, that kind of thing. You can still do that. Any system that imposes a pattern over an essential randomness can be used for divination. And some very ingenious ones have been done that with in the past. The I Ching, for example, uses, coins or yarrow sticks that are thrown down, and so it's a matter of whether your coins come up heads or tails, which, how the pattern is laid out. And then you get eight different tosses, and whether the coins come up, say, heads or tails gives you a dash or a line, or a space or a line, and you can put those onto a map, and this gives you a direction. They all work like that. It's fascinating.
All right, another area that your school is involved in teaching, a different department, is alchemy and magical sciences. Now, I know that alchemy is something that is of high interest to a lot of people around the world, and that includes people that are in our audience. What is alchemy, and what are magical sciences?
Well, alchemy is essentially the art and science of transformation and transmutation. In essence, it's an Arabic term, and this is one of those places where we have wizardry from the Islamic Arabic traditions, which is where pretty much all the sciences originated there. The Arabic sciences preceded Western science by centuries, and there were three major goals to the alchemists, and these operated in two basic dimensions. There was the dimension of the physical world and the dimension of the spiritual realm. And these three primary objectives were defined as the philosopher's stone, the search for the philosopher's stone, which is a way to transmute anything into something else. That was the quest of that. And then there was the homunculus, which was the artificial life. The creating of the homunculus literally means a little man. And then there was the elixir, which is the secret of eternal life. And these were the ways that these three goals were specified. In the material plane, then, this was a search for a way to turn, say, lead into gold. But it follows through in all aspects of modern chemistry and nuclear science and everything else, where we seek to manipulate the molecules themselves, the very essence of being and matter, and create and transform these into other things. With the alchemists, they were primarily focused on lead into gold, but their descendants, the modern chemists, who even retained the name, have used this for just every aspect of chemistry today.
One of the things that a lot of people don't know, and they never really stop to think about, the father of modern science very often is, people refer to John Newton as the father of, I'm sorry, Isaac Newton, as the father of modern science. He was an alchemist.
Yes. He was considered both the first scientist and the last wizard, depending on who you're talking to. And he pursued both paths equally avidly.
Yeah. You know, what's happened, we're getting outside help, and they're attempting to break up your conversation here. So I'll tell you what we're going to do. I'm going to go ahead and release the line, and we're going to call you back from a different line and see if we can get a better connection, because it's really getting to the point where they're breaking your conversation up, and we can't really understand what you're saying. So we'll do that, and then we will continue. It's a shame, but as you know, this show is not the only one that gets targeted for that. This show is just one among many that gets targeted for that sort of thing. So, are you back with us now, Headmaster?
I can hear you fine. Do you hear me all right?
We can hear you fine. They were just shutting you down is what was happening.
Wow.
We happen to live in a time here in the land of the free where radio broadcasts get targeted like this. And I was saying to my audience, we're not the only ones. It happens to us, but it happens to others too. All right, so I had just said that Newton was an alchemist, and a lot of people don't know that.
Yes.
And these days you have a lot of scientists that scoff at the idea of alchemy, and yet that's their birthplace.
Yes, it is, and it really hasn't changed. The goals of science today are really not that dissimilar. Our quest to master the elements and create all kinds of amazing new substances and molecular manipulation and all the rest of that stuff, that's pure Philosopher's Stone stuff. Our quest to create artificial intelligence and robotics, that's just a continuation of the search for the homunculus. Our advances in medicine and research into anti-aging, this is straight out of the search for the elixir. These goals have not changed, really. You know, we are still practicing alchemy. It's just that in the 1660s, when the scientific revolution occurred, they wanted to disavow all relationships with the older magical systems.
Yeah, but you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. We have to take a break. We'll be back. More with Headmaster Oberon Zell Ravenheart right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and to my guest, Headmaster Oberon Zell Ravenheart. Whenever we talk about alchemy, there are people who, you know, they conjure in their minds a vision of something they saw in a movie. But let me ask you, in reality, is transmutation actually possible?
Well, that's a very, very good question in a sense, but really we have better transformation today in modern chemical laboratories than I think we had in the alchemists' laboratories of ancient time. However, many of the important chemicals and elements and compounds that we do use today were in fact discovered and first described by the alchemists. So there is that foundation. But the transformation of lead into gold seems to have been pretty much a trick rather than a reality. There are some very clever ways of doing it. The most obvious one that we might look at today, for example, is electroplating, which we do all the time in making, you know, gold-plated jewelry and such.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some more subtle and even clever ways, but all of them were incredibly dangerous because they all utilized mercury, which the fumes of which were incredibly toxic and rather maddening. So alchemy, as it was actually practiced in the ancient laboratories, was really a very unhealthy thing, and it did not have a high survival value. But lots of things were learned that are now applied in modern chemistry science. So there you go. They just had a lot to learn about toxicity.
Okay. And I bet you can tell in advance what the next one is that everyone is going to be interested in, and that's the dark arts.
That would be the dark arts, yes.
Yeah. Now, are you teaching in the school, are you teaching the dark arts, or are you teaching how to prevent and defend against the dark arts, or both?
Well, we teach both, really. We're not teaching people that they should go out and practice the dark arts in a negative way. But the dark arts really encompasses, well, the term is sorcery, really. Dark arts, the black arts, sorcery, practical magic, low magic, all these terms are terms that were used to refer to magic which is designed to affect the physical world in some way. And the best overall term for that, and the least prejudicial really, is the least loaded, is probably sorcery. Hence, dark arts practitioners were often referred to as sorcerers in ancient times, and there's a very negative connotation with that word, as opposed to someone who may practice sorcery as a part of the rest of their work. Pretty much any practitioner of magic practices sorcery, and there are many perfectly wonderful people who even use the term to refer to themselves as sorcerers. Dumbledore in the Harry Potter stories was referred to as a great sorcerer. But so the terms are used kind of loosely. But these involve everything from, well, these are where the laws of magic come into being, the laws of association and connection and, oh, well, there's actually quite a lot of them, really. But the principle here is all around doing something in some physical way that will affect something else in a physical way. The underlying principle that underlies all magic, in fact, all wizardry, in fact, is the essence of the wisdom of the ages, can be summed up in the phrase omnia vivant, omnia inter se connexa. That's Latin, that it means everything is alive, everything is interconnected. And it's that principle that that gives rise to the conception that if you can, say, have something that was once connected with something else, and you can manipulate the one thing, it will affect the other thing somewhere, like the principle of the voodoo doll concept. So all these things fall into sorcery, but so there's the practice of sorcery. This is the dark arts. It doesn't necessarily mean it's bad. The original name came from Egypt, where the magic of Egypt was called black magic because Egypt was the black land. From the fertile soil of Egypt was the black soil, as opposed to the sterile soil of the desert, which was red. So we talk about white versus black. They talked about red versus black is the thing, you know. But in that concept, red was bad and black was good. But I don't like those terms because they also have very racial connotations, which are offensive, I think. So we try to avoid that specifically. But the defense against the dark arts also deals with defending yourself against being affected by people's attempts to manipulate you and to affect you in ways that you would not want to be affected and stuff. And a great deal of malevolent magic, pretty much all of the malevolent magic that's been wielded, falls into the category of sorcery or the dark arts. So defense against the dark arts is a very important part of it.
Okay, now, let me ask you this question here before our next break comes up.
Mm-hmm.
As a wizard, and as the headmaster of a wizardry school, and as someone who's written well-recognized authoritative books on the subject, you're dealing with topics that go way back, way, way back in human history. But you also live with the rest of us in the 21st century. All right, now, as a 21st century man who happens to be a wizard, have you seen these dark arts, these manipulations of one thing to cause a change in something else it's connected to? Have you actually seen this work?
Oh, yes, yes, I have. It's actually remarkably effective stuff. There's a lot of that kind of work that's done. Well, you know, weather magic is a very good example with that kind of a thing, but one could even say that a lot of types of healing modalities utilize sorcery, and certainly all of the techniques used in such magical systems, you know, as voodoo and such like that, and hoodoo, really, it's really hoodoo is the thing, they can be very effective, very powerful. The means by which these are affected are endlessly debated, you know, whether it's the belief of everybody involved that creates the reality or whether you're affecting the quantum field in some way. There's been some very interesting experiments in particle physics that suggest that, in fact, particles that have been together and are separated can still have influence on each other. So science is backing some of this up in interesting ways. But magical practice is not really so much involved in a theory of why a thing might work as in how to actually use it. It's like, you know, being able to drive a car without necessarily knowing, you know, all the principles of thermodynamics that go into it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, almost everyone listening to the show knows how to drive a car, and very few of them know how to fix one.
Right. Well, and that's it, you know. That's exactly mm-hmm. it. And it applies to magic as well. And, of course, magic has always been a very esoteric field. Only a very small handful of people have ever really studied it well enough to understand it. To everyone else, it's just this weird, mysterious stuff. But then, for most people in the modern world, the same can be said of what we call science. I mean, very few people today really have any comprehension of how science works and what it really means and stuff. Very few people could explain how their computers operate. You know, what are the principles behind that? How did they get the results that they get out of that from a little chip? You know, how does that all happen? You know, let alone all the other areas that we deal with all the time. We take them for granted when we use them. But exactly how they work, hey, 50% of the people in this country apparently don't even believe in evolution. I mean, so it's like, you know, you might as well be living in the Middle Ages as far as people's knowledge of how the world works is concerned.
Well, I use a microwave, and I use it religiously.
Very good.
But, you know, there's no way I could build one. I don't know how it works. I know if you punch the buttons on the front and hit start, you heat up your food. Exactly. That's all I know about it.
Well, Arthur C. Clarke made that famous statement that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Yeah.
And I think that's very true. And one could also say the converse, that any sufficiently developed magic is indistinguishable from science.
All right, we have to step away for a break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more with Headmaster Oberon Zell, and then we'll take your calls. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you who are joining us just now in our second hour, welcome aboard. My guest this evening is Headmaster Oberon Zell Ravenheart, and he is the headmaster of the Gray School of Wizardry, a real headmaster, a real wizard of a real school of wizardry. One thing that I haven't touched on is that the Gray School of Wizardry is a licensed school in the state of California, right?
That's right, and we also have a 501c3 as an educational institution as well. So, yes, we're fully incorporated and legal and all the rest of that good stuff.
All right, I want to, we'll delve more into some of these deep subjects as we go along, but right here, at this point, I've got to ask you a question I've been dying to ask you. And it's a little bit frivolous, but when the Harry Potter movies first came out, were you surprised by how much Dumbledore resembles you?
Well, you know, it's been remarked by many people. It was, I've looked like that for decades, you know, but I just find it delightful myself, of course. But I always enjoy the depictions of wizards in movies and TV shows and such. Especially, of course, ones that look like me, naturally, you know. it's a delight. The fun thing about it is that really, as opposed to depictions of, say, witches, the depictions of wizards are pretty uniformly fairly accurate in their, except for the fantasy element of it, of course, but they're not that far off the mark. They're depicted as the wise ones, the teachers, those who whose job it is to instruct the young hero on what he needs to know before he goes off on the quest. You know, so you get characters like Dumbledore or Merlin or Gandalf or Obi-Wan Kenobi, and it's all very, very similar and very, very real. That's pretty much what it's all about. The wizards are the teachers and the wise ones that people come to who are supposed to know stuff.
Well, and see, that brings up that brings up then this whole subject of that I know has to be going through some folks' minds is the association that we've seen many times in the movies, wizardry with something evil, or wizardry with connected and somehow with Satanism or the dark side of the Force, that sort of thing. For instance, in Star Wars, the Emperor is most certainly a wizard that is on the side of darkness and evil. So is wizardry? Is there anything associated with it that we should look at and say, okay, that's evil, or that's affiliated with Satanism? How about that?
Well, I think you'd be pretty hard pressed to find any association with Satanism. Wizards are generally, no matter how their personal predilections are, I can't imagine anybody with the smarts to be in that category, you know, going after worshiping Satan. That is just such a preposterous notion that it just isn't even on the table. But when you see the evil characters in something like Star Wars and stuff, they're not treated the same way. They're regarded as someone who's departed from the path because they have sought power. That's most clearly stated when Gandalf says to Saruman, you know, when did Saruman the Wise, lose all wisdom? And because he sought power, you see, and that was the essence of it all. So at that point, this is where people like this are usually referred to as sorcerers as opposed to wizards. And if those two terms are used, they're used in opposition like that, so that the evil characters are usually called something else other than wizards. The term wizards is generally reserved for, well, the wise one.
Okay, so Aleister Crowley then would not be a wizard, but a sorcerer.
Yes, definitely. Absolutely. He was many things, a ceremonial magician, a sorcerer, many things. But it would be a stretch to consider him a wizard in the sense that we are using the term of a wise one, yes.
Fair enough.
Really a stretch.
Fair enough. All right, I want to open up the telephone lines and allow folks in the audience to give us a call. The telephone number is, for those of you who are watching on our television feed, the telephone numbers are appearing on your screen. 623-444-5889 is the main number. If you need to call us on the toll-free number, it is 888-223-4599. And if you happen to live outside of the USA, you happen to live outside of Canada, so you're in Europe, you're in Asia, you're in Australia, wherever, but you're not in the USA, you're not in Canada, those numbers will work if you wish to call them. However, if you don't want to make that international long-distance call, you can use something called a flash message. You just go to my website, scroll down, and when you scroll down, you'll see a link that says flash message. You may use that and send me a message, a question, or a comment,
and we will read it on the air and allow our guests to comment upon it. But again, the telephone numbers are 623-444-5889 or toll-free 888-223-4599. Now, Headmaster, we talk very often on this show about UFOs and extraterrestrials. And we try to approach it without all of the gee whiz, good golly, Miss Molly aspect. We try to approach the subject sensibly and rationally and try to figure it out. But one of the things that comes through pretty frequently is that when people have some sort of contact, some sort of personal encounter with these extraterrestrials, whether they look like what we normally refer to as the small grays or as the tall whites, the Nordics, or reptilians, whatever they happen to look like, one thing that comes through is that these beings seem to be able to take control of a person's mind and speak directly into their mind, sort of telepathically. Sometimes they're able to induce paralysis so that you can't move, and you just have to sit there, stand there, or lay there and listen to what they're saying into your mind. Is there anything in wizardry that would help us to have control over that situation?
Well, I think this gets into the realm of the psychic arts, in particular the realms of hypnosis and dreamwalking and mental projection, and these kind of things really are the kind of things that you're talking about here. And this is some of the stuff that we teach about in our Defense Against the Dark Arts department, is how to protect yourself against those kind of influences. Because if you don't have any defenses set up, any shielding, any wards — these are all some of the terms and processes that are used, shielding, wards, things like that — it's very easy to have your mind subsumed by another. The most obvious example of that being in hypnosis. I have suspected for some time that some of these encounters that have been reported, they seem like staged events, and perhaps there are means of projecting almost like holographically things that are people are supposed to see, and perhaps ways of inducing visions into their minds directly that may or may not be entirely physical. Many of these things may be far more a mental perception than a physical one, because the world that we experience is the one that goes on inside our head, you know. So if one can induce that, if one can project in some way visions or ideas into one's head as one experiences in dreams or under hypnosis, well, then there's really no limit to what someone may report as having experienced, because they have experienced it in the very same way they experience anything else.
Well, that makes sense. Now, some of the experiences, though, some of the encounters, in fact, I think it's close to 50% of these encounters happen while the person is wide awake, and they're fully conscious of what's happening, but are unable to do anything about it.
Well, exactly. And hypnosis works on people who are wide awake. You don't hypnotize somebody who's asleep. You hypnotize somebody who's awake.
Good point.
You know, and they're... Pardon?
I said that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to the telephone and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. It's Debbie from Columbus.
Hi, Debbie.
Hi. I wanted to ask Oberon a question. Oberon, I do, I'm a holistic health practitioner, so a number of the modalities that you're talking about I work with already. Is it possible to take just like some classes from your school instead of taking the whole lot, or?
We've been talking about that. We've had a number of people inquiring about whether we can create a system where somebody can just simply come in as an adult anyway. We wouldn't want to do this for the teenagers in the same sense, and be able to just simply selectively take classes. They would have to work. We haven't really worked out exactly how to administer that, but it's on our agenda of things to do. So it may take a little while. In the meantime, however, you can come to the school and simply major in a particular department, because you've got a choice of hundreds of classes, and there's enough to keep you pretty busy for a while there.
That sounds like it.
So, this is a very good question, and we really are considering how to do that and make it work.
Okay, well, thank you for answering my question. Have a good night, Kevin.
All right, thanks for the call. 623-444-5889, or toll-free at 888-223-4599. People need to know, we haven't talked about this, but people need to know that the school is online, and so it's fully interactive.
Website, please. Please give the website for it.
Yeah. First, let me say that, as usual, if you click Headmaster Oberon Zell's photograph that's on my website, it will take you to the school. It's linked.
Good.
But for those of you who are listening by radio right now and you are not looking at a website, the web address is Gray School, and that's spelled G-R-E-Y, grayschool.com. That's the website. And I think you'll be pretty impressed with what you see there. Now, that brings up this question. To what degree does belief play a role in whether magic works or not?
Well, a great deal of it, really. A lot of working magic really does require both a suspension of disbelief and a strong conviction in what you're doing. This is where the art part of it comes into being. But this is true for any of the arts, if you think about it. If you're going to be a musician and be effective, you have to really believe in what you're doing and that you can do it. If you're going to be an actor, you have to believe in your role. If you're going to be a dancer, if you falter in the middle of it and say, gee, I don't think I can do this, you know, it's all over and you're flat on your face. And magic is really much more of an art than a science, although it utilizes both, but then so do any of the arts. But it is called the art. A-R-T-E is one of the great classical terms for all the fields of magic, the art.
All right. Now, whenever someone enrolls in the school, you told Debbie that you can just choose a major and major in one of these courses of study.
That's right.
But let's say I come to the school, I enroll in the school, I don't know what I want to study. Do you have sort of a course outline that takes me from A to Z?
Yes, we do. We have, when you first come in, there are four required classes that you need to take at the first level. And these kind of introduce you to the different things there. We don't expect students to decide on a major until their second level, their second year level. I could use the word year, but then people would think it was chronological, and it's not chronological years. The levels correspond to what you might get in a chronological year if you're going to a bricks and mortar school, but people can take the courses at whatever pace they wish, so we really refer to them as levels in that sense, and there are, as you said, seven of these. So it's at the second one that you select your major, and you can select minors as well, and it's pretty much like any other academic curriculum. You have your majors, your minors, and when you graduate, your certificate acknowledges that, and it says on it what you specialized in.
And you get a certificate that identifies you as an apprentice wizard, right?
No, you get a certificate upon graduation that identifies you as a journeyman wizard, because the next stage after apprentice is journeyman. And we are, in fact, planning on developing a level for journeyman studies, which would be the equivalent of a four-year college. The apprentice level is the equivalent of middle school through high school, as is the level involved. The journeyman level would be the equivalent of college, and then you would have the master's level, which would be the equivalent to graduate school. And upon the completion of all these, you get the appropriate diploma or degree. Upon completion of the journeyman studies, you get a master's degree. Upon the completion of the master's studies, you get an adeptus degree, which is pretty much exactly the same as a PhD, which means literally doctor of philosophy. And philosophy, as I mentioned, means love of wisdom. So a PhD really says that you're a wizard, you know.
All right, let's go back to the telephone caller. You're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hey, this is Doc in Arkansas. I just want to give you guys a holler and tell you that I was looking for that web address and I noticed it was missing the L off school.
On my website?
No, on the address you were saying there, talking in the show, about, you know, the www for the address for had a school.
Yeah, grayschool.com.
Yeah, it's spelling on your website. It's spelled wrong.
Okay, we'll get it fixed. All right.
Oops.
Yeah. Okay, we'll get that fixed. Maybe before the show is over, but certainly right after the show. But it's grayschool.com. And Bob, did you go over and take a look at it?
There you go.
Yeah, Bob, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm with you.
Did you take a look at the grayschool.com?
Yes, I did, sir. I took a look at it. I figured out, put the L there, how, yeah, I went there and looked at it. It's a real nice page.
It is indeed.
Good information.
Yeah. Are you a wizard, Bob?
No, I'm just interested in, you know, I always watch your show from Arkansas.
Outstanding. What part of Arkansas are you in?
Harrison.
I've been through Harrison, Arkansas. I sure have. All right, Bob, thanks for the call.
You have a good night, sir.
All right. All righty then. Yeah, I've been through Harrison, Arkansas. It was snowing when I went through Harrison, Arkansas several years ago. All right, the telephone number is 623-444-5889. Or toll free, 888-223-4599, 888-223-4599. If you're outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, you can send me a flash message by going to my website, scroll down, and you'll find the link that says flash message, and you can put your comment or your question there.
By the way, Kevin,
yes.
Your listeners might be interested to know that there's a lot more to the Gray School than just the academics, too. We have the houses and the lodges, we have clubs, we have social interactions, we have group forums, we have competitions, we have even summer camps, conclave summer camps that take place all around the country. And next year we'll be having our first conclave in Australia as well. So there's really quite a lot more to the school, just like in the Hogwarts school and the Harry Potter stories. It's not all just about the classes, too, you know.
What is a conclave?
A lot more. Well, it's a summer camp. It's a summer camp where some of them go as long as 10 days. Most of them are about a week. A few are just as short as a long weekend. But students and teachers meet together in different areas where there's at least one teacher and enough students to justify doing it, and camp out and have campfires and have classes and learn to make wands and dream catchers and all kinds of stuff, sit around the campfire at night and tell stories, learn about the stars. It's really quite wonderful. It's just great. It's an incredible hands-on experience where people get to meet. So it's not just a matter of online stuff. Just as we have actual faculty actually teaching the classes and not just correspondence course that's all anonymous, you do interact with these amazing teachers if you take the classes. We also have all this interactivity between the students and the teachers and on all these levels. It's really quite a complete program.
All right, let's talk about wands for a minute.
Sure.
Why? What's the purpose of the wand? What's it for?
Well, the wand, it's like a conduit. It's like a way of directing one's energy in a certain way. Sort of a psychic pointer almost, you know, like a teacher might have a pointer stick or a laser pointer or something. A wand serves that purpose. It focuses and directs your magic in a very precise way as opposed to just flashing all out. And sure, you can do some of that stuff with, you know, pointing your finger the right way, but the wand is created specifically to be a conduit for your own magical energy, and it's very personal. Ideally, people should make their own wands, and we have classes in wand making. I mean, you can buy very nice ones, and most wizards have quite a collection of ones that they've bought or there are other people have given them and such. But the ones that are the special ones are the ones that you make, and the whole way you do that is a very magical process that makes it very personal. So that's really the essence of the whole thing with wands.
So does the wand act like a megaphone for your power? Or
exactly. A nice analogy, a very nice analogy, exactly what it does. Yes, it focuses, amplifies, and directs your power into a particular focus. And if you're practicing any kind of thing that involves focusing on an object of some sort, whether it's a person, if you're doing a healing, for instance, or whether it's, say, a crystal that you're going to be sending out for some particular purpose, this is the way to create that focus.
All right, we're less than a minute away from our next break, and I really don't want to dive into this before the break, because I know just as you get into it, we're going to get caught by the break, and they happen automatically. Once they start, I've got 30 seconds to clear off the microphone, because it'll clear me off if I don't. So because they're what we call hard breaks. All right, so let me introduce, though, what I want us to talk about. And I think it's important because of many of the topics that we discuss on this show. I want us to talk about Beast Mastery. That's one of the departments. And there's a specific couple of reasons why we need to talk about Beast Mastery. We'll be back, folks, right after this. More with Oberon Zell. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and to my guest, Headmaster Oberon Zell Ravenheart. He is the headmaster of the Gray School of Wizardry, and we're talking about what is wizardry and what are some of these different courses that are taught in the school. Now, one of the departments, Headmaster, that you have listed here is Beast Mastery. We talk about lots of different kinds of beasts here. We talk about Bigfoot. We talk about shapeshifters. Last night I had a Navajo chief on the show who talked with us about skinwalkers. And what a fascinating subject that was. We have talked about chupacabras. Last night, the Navajo chief and a researcher that works with him, or maybe the Navajo chief works with this researcher, anyway, they work together, told us about some valleys, some canyons here in Arizona where there are animals that many people have thought are extinct. They told us with great assurance that there are living dinosaurs, smaller ones, but living dinosaurs in some of those canyons, and they both have been seen and their footprints plaster casted. What is Beast
Valley of the Guanji?
Yeah. What is Beast Mastery? What's that about?
Well, it's all aspects of dealing with animals. It's brown magic, and it really encompasses quite a wide area, everything from veterinary medicine to horse whispering and dog whispering and all that stuff. It does encompass mythical and legendary creatures as well, of all sorts. I wrote a whole book just on legendary magical creatures called The Wizard's Bestiary, which I think is probably the definitive book on this subject that has ever been written. I've got over 1,000 creatures and over 1,500 illustrations in it. And so it's a fairly broad field. It includes totems, it includes familiars, it includes things like Bigfoot and Nessie and Chupacabra and all that stuff. And there's all the ones that stride the borderlands, such as dragons and unicorns and all. I personally had some experience in that. I raised unicorns for a number of years back in the 80s.
Whoa, wait a minute, time out. We got to park right here for a minute. Real unicorns?
Yes, real unicorns. I'm amazed that people seem to have forgotten it so soon. It was just a huge news event at the time. I was on every newspaper everywhere, in magazines and TV and radio. It was just enormous. It was huge.
I can imagine it would be, but I have to confess I had not heard of it.
I'm constantly amazed by that. I really am. I'm continually running into that. It's like somehow the unicorns just erase themselves from human memory periodically over time. They have recurred and reappeared several times throughout history at approximately 500-year intervals. And every time, it's not very long afterwards that they are completely forgotten and regarded as mythical again. It's just astonishing. I really find that amazing. But you can find out more if you want to. There's a really good interview and lots of color pictures on the SideshowWorlds.com. There's an interview that they've got, if you check those out, that says The Great and Powerful Oz. Or you can go to my personal website, oberonzell.com, and click onto the link to that. And you can find out all about it. But that's what I did in the 80s. The first unicorns were born in 1980, and throughout that entire decade, my entire life was wrapped around raising unicorns. Eventually, I arranged a 4-year lease with the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus, and they exhibited them all over the world. They were the star of the greatest show on earth for 4 years.
So, and then what happened to them?
Well, my life changed, and I wasn't in a position to raise any more. I moved out of the country, and I had other things to do. I mean, during that time, that was all I did. It was huge. My wife and I both. That was our entire life. We were at every Renaissance fair in the United States and Canada exhibiting them. It was just an enormous thing. And the ones that we had eventually grew old and died, and we didn't raise any more, and that was the end of it. The last one died about 2 years ago.
And all right, now they look like horses, right? Except they have this horn.
No, they don't look like horses. If you look at the tapestries, this is the crux of the whole thing. People have gotten really wrong in modern times because of this horse thing, which was a constant argument we had to have with people. But if you look at the tapestries, you will see that they are always depicted as cloven-hoofed, fairly small, bearded chins, little tufted tails. They are not derived from horses. They are derived from various sorts of horned animals, but the most famous ones are derived from goats. In fact, recently I saw a news report and a photograph of a deer unicorn that was seen and photographed in some forest in Europe, and that would be a Chervian unicorn. Unicorns are defined by the species name, so you have the goat unicorns or caprine unicorns. If there were horse unicorns, they would be called equine, but of course there aren't, because horses don't have horns, a thing that we had to constantly point out to people. There were antelopine unicorns, there were even taurine unicorns, arine unicorns, all kinds of different horned species have given rise to unicorns. And the process of inducing a two-horned animal to grow a single horn from the center of its forehead is a magical secret that was discovered and lost a number of times throughout human history, but it's documented, and we were able to find out the documentation, and this time around, I happened to be the one to have discovered the secret, and so that's what we did throughout the 80s. It was quite an exciting time.
Now, okay, forgive my ignorance on this, because that's one place where all I know about unicorns is what I've seen in movies, and it's always a horse.
Problem.
Yeah, but in those movies, even though it was a horse, it was always either claimed or at least exhibited that the unicorn had some magical powers.
Oh, yes, that's definitely a part of the whole story, and it's really quite fascinating. The animals are uncanny. They are really so uncanny. They are so different than anything else. It's hard to describe. It's like they are They have a charisma about them. They have an intelligence and a sentience. They're just amazing. Their whole structure is completely different. The structure of their skull and their brain and their third eye and everything else is just completely different from a normal two-horned animal in every way. And they're quite remarkable. Their sense of smell, for example, just as a single example, is enormously amplified by the fact that their sinuses grow up into the horn, and the horn is hollow and honeycombed with spaces, so their sense of smell is magnified, you know, many, many times over the normal sense of smell. The frontal lobes of the brain expand enormously because they are not depressed by the boss that thickens the skull over the temporal, I mean over the frontal lobes in a normal two-horned animal. They don't have that. They're incredibly powerful. Their neck and shoulder muscles are hugely powerful and very different than. I mean, really, people would not recognize the parent species just from seeing the animal. They're that different, really. They're quite remarkable.
Well, what is it that when we talk about beast mastery? What is it that we're mastering? What are we getting to where we can talk to animals and like Dr. Doolittle?
Pretty close.
Really?
To it. Yep. There's aspects of animal communication that are very specialized, but people do learn that. I mean, think about this. I mean, if you have a dog or a cat, your animal probably understands you pretty well. You can probably communicate with them really well. The thing that must be frustrating and really question their relative intelligence is how one-sided that is. You know, we don't seem to usually understand our animals nearly as well as they seem to understand us. And this is about how to do that and improve that so we can learn to go both ways with that. So, yes, animal communications, being able to talk to the animals in whatever ways they do, that's part of the art of the horse whisperer, of the dog whisperer, is to do that very thing. It just covers so many areas. The whole area of totems, of finding the animal that your soul most resonates with. There's the concept that many people hold that when we incarnate, our souls don't pass intact from one person to the next, but they kind of go into some sort of a pool and are dipped out again, and maybe a mix of souls that are in there from other creatures as well, so that some people have a strong element of wolf to them, or bear, or tiger, or it's often usually predators, but not always, you know.
Well, you know, the term, I think most people are familiar with the term werewolf, but were is the old word for man. So werewolf means man wolf, but there's also were rabbits, were deer, were jaguars. It's not just the werewolf.
Yes, indeed.
All right. Now, in this course on beast mastery, does this include magic for turning into a beast?
Well, it's magic for being able to attune with them so well that you can kind of look out through their eyes. This is where familiars come into the thing. The part of the art of really having and developing a familiar as opposed to a pet is that you can actually, especially when you're sleeping, you can dream fast with them. In your dreams, you can look out through their eyes. And so if you get really good at this, you can send them out and as, like, you know, your own eyes on the move. If this is done very effectively, it's like dream walking. It's like going into someone else's dream. You're going into the mind of an animal where you then inhabit them. And so that's an element of this. And this is a very real thing. I've done this myself quite often, having that kind of relationship with an animal. The psychic bonding can be very intense. There's some animals that are much better at that than others. You know, dogs, cats. Some snakes are particularly really good at that sort of thing.
Snakes?
Popular as familiars because of that.
I would not have thought that a snake would be. I tend to think of a snake's brain as being rather primitive.
Well, it is, and that's the interesting thing. And oddly enough, the snakes that make the best familiars are those in the most primitive species, the boas and the pythons. They are really excellent familiars, make really good, especially boa constrictors, and some pythons. Some don't work as well as others. Burmese pythons are particularly good, And South American boa constrictors are particularly good, and those are really the best. The little colubrids that people get, the corn snakes and all, they're very pretty, but they're totally useless. If you know, they haven't got a brain of a rock. It isn't the intelligence of the snakes. It's quite contrary. See, snakes have no hearing. They have no ears, so they don't have any of that entire sense that we use there. And their eyes, they evolved from eyeless lizards that completely recreated eyes, and their eyes are completely different from the eyes of any other living creature on the planet because they evolved independently and separately from something that didn't have them. And all these things give them a high capacity for psychic attunement.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back. We are on Final Approach. That means we only have a few minutes left. And if you have a question or comment, the lines are open, 623-444-5889, or toll free at 888-223-4599. My guest this evening is Oberon Zell Ravenheart. He is the headmaster at the Gray School of Wizardry. And we're talking about real wizardry as opposed to the fictionalized stuff that we see on television and in the movies and on DVDs. We've just got these few minutes left, and we were talking about beast mastery. What I'm wondering is this. We talk about Bigfoot here on this show rather frequently. And it is a phenomenon that has been seen around the world. People from every strata of society have seen Bigfoot. Military people, just common everyday people like me out camping have seen them. Psychiatrists have seen them. I've had a psychiatrist on this show, a practicing psychiatrist, that he and his family have seen a Bigfoot. And so here's my question. These creatures seem to be very elusive. If we were to take this course on beast mastery, would we perhaps be able then to communicate in some way with Bigfoot and perhaps establish some contact where they don't run away into the woods but stay and communicate with us?
Well, I would say that the studies that we teach in the Gray School would be very helpful for that. The studies, especially in the fields of the psychic arts, being able to go into a kind of a space that renders you essentially part of the landscape and opens up your psychic sensitivities to both receive and to project, would be extremely useful for that. Bigfoot is one of the, I think, the last of the real creatures that have not yet been brought into the official scientific categories. But I personally feel that the evidence is compelling for their existence. And they're not really fantastical, you know, like a lot of the creatures of legend, like griffins and dragons and things. They seem very reasonable and very real. And the vast areas that they seem to be their natural habitat, the taiga that surrounds the entire pole, the largest forest on Earth, is such a huge area. I mean, we have entire species of apes that whose entire range is just a few square miles. So the idea of such a creature as what we call Bigfoot and is known by many, many other names around all the northern countries does not seem at all unlikely. I think what seems unlikely to people is that something that seems so close to human could somehow have survived our human efforts at exterminating all of our associated hominid species. And I think they may be the last other one that's still left. If I was to choose among all the possible candidates, I would I would say that the one that would seem most likely to be would be the one that they call Paranthropus, or Australopithecus boy's eye is another term for them, which they emerged very parallel to our ancestors, the Australopithecus africanus and the Gracilis in Africa, and they were much larger, and they were vegetarian, and they were more heavily built in all ways, and really our reconstructions of them from the fossils look uncannily like the reconstructions that we have from descriptions and drawings and photographs of Bigfoot. So, you know, there we are. I would like myself to pursue that at some point. I have my own ideas, and it'd be great to see them reach pure fruition.
All right. Let's go to the telephone line, and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
I'm Ben Harris.
Hi, Ben.
Yeah, I'm from Hollywood, South California.
Yeah. If you will, turn down your radio or your computer, because we can hear me in the background on delay.
No problem.
Yeah, turn it down, and then we'll continue.
Yeah, that's down.
Okie dokie. What's your question or your comment?
Comment on the Bigfoot. It seems like it's a kind of a mystery, the Bigfoot, and while I was taking the NASA videos and cleaning them up and defiltering them, I saw lots of pictures of Bigfoot, and I have other pictures of Bigfoot openly associating with bears and humans. And my assumption is that since the Bigfoot does seem to be indigenous to Mars, I think at one time the humans, being so primitive, a lot of them there, that they interbred, and the Bigfoot is the human-like result of that romance.
Hmm.
Well, that was a big jump, indigenous to Mars. We went from the northern forest to Mars. I'm not sure I followed you on that leap there, but...
My guess is that I would surmise from studying the situation that the Bigfoot was dropped off on the Earth and maybe a couple of zebras were grabbed and taken there. I think it's operating more at that level, not, you know, like that. And the Bigfoot is placed around on the planet here.
It's a little bit difficult these days to entertain the idea of you know, a flourishing ecosystem on the planet Mars somehow. I'm having a little trouble wrapping my head around that.
Days
of Edgar Rice Burroughs and John Carter of Barsoom, you know.
Well, but now even NASA is saying that there was a time in Mars history when there were lakes and oceans and temperate climate and atmosphere, and that it's very, very possible and possibly even likely that there was life and vegetation and so forth at some point in its past.
Oh, yeah, and I've seen NASA photographs close up in 3D that look like old deteriorated seashells on the beach, and they're very compelling. I would expect us to find evidence of past life on Mars, and perhaps even...
Oh, yeah, Robert O'Dean, in his lecture in Barcelona, shows a infrared picture of a city underground.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting as well. But now, let me say this. Okay. Because of time, I'm going to have to cut the call short. But let me say this very quickly. Have you seen the photograph, the NASA photograph, of what looks like a forest on Mars?
Have you? I haven't, no.
Oh, yes, I have. And I was introduced to that first by Arthur C. Clarke,
really?
Who most people think of him as a science fiction writer, which he was, but before that he was a scientist who invented the geosynchronous orbit that is used by everyone today who uses a cell phone. He's the one that figured out how to do a geosynchronous orbit and use it for telecommunications. But there is a photograph, a NASA photograph, from Mars. This was shot by the Mars Global Surveyor, and it shows a forest of what looks like gigantic banyan trees. And Arthur C. Clarke, when he saw it, said, "That's it. That ends the debate. There is life on Mars."
Well, I really want us to go there. I really do, you know. The little rovers have been fascinating, but they haven't shown us anything particularly interesting. And I would really like to have a human, you know, mission and you know, all the rest of it stuff. So, you know, it's exciting to know there's still some mystery out there. That's wonderful. You know?
Yeah, but you know, I have my doubts as to whether we will go there, because there's a panel now appointed by the president that has gone through the NASA budget, and they are saying, number one, we don't have the money in the budget to go back to the moon. Number two, Mars is too dangerous. So if this panel has its way, we're through with space exploration.
Well, I hope that's not the end of it. If it isn't this administration, perhaps the next one will have the vision. But if there's, it seems to me, if there's the money to fight these wars, then there's certainly enough money for a space program. So I don't think that's it.
Yeah. I hate to do it, but we've come to the end of the show. Oberon, if you will, just stay on the line with me. I want to talk with you for a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, Oberon Zell Ravenheart, the website to go to is grayschool.com. He's the headmaster of that school of wizardry. My thanks to him for being with us this evening. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.